high wheelbase and lots of room, big American cars seem to have found love in France.
Pretty much one car out of two that is sold is an SUV.
Which has put a squeeze on cities, so Paris will start charging SUVs extra for parking. Also today, Brits have opened their homes to Ukrainians fleeing war, but not to people from Sudan, a former British colony. There are questions.
Why are we not letting them rebuild here in the UK in the ways that we know they can?
I'm Marco Werman, and the historic marshlands of southern Iraq are dying. It's a water crisis that some are trying to stop.
I'm in love with the nature. I want to be part of saving this nature and the biodiversity in Iraq.
Plus, we look back on the life of Milan Kundera, a Czech novelist who captured life under Soviet repression. All that and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Just a week away, but oh, the anticipation for the Women's World Cup of Soccer. We've come a long way since 1999, when Brandi Chastain nailed the penalty kick to give Team USA the cup.
Goal!
One word, goal. It's taken a generation for some folks to realize the potential for the women's game. This summer, FIFA expects more than 2 billion people to tune in to the matches. U.S. soccer legend Megan Rapinoe said the tournament is part of a massive cultural moment for all women's sports.
Globally, you've seen what's happened since last World Cup, whether it's stadium selling out or the Women's Final Four or Cricket League in India. Like, there's so many examples of this.
The host countries, Australia and New Zealand, are banking on the World Cup, keeping things rolling, and officials are taking steps to make sure women's sports remain top of mind. The World's Bianca Hillier starts our coverage.
From the jump, Australia and New Zealand said their Women's World Cup would make history. New Zealand football president Johanna Wood spelled it out in their final bid video.
The first ever FIFA World Cup across confederation boundaries, the first FIFA Women's World Cup in the Asia Pacific, and the first in the Southern Hemisphere.
But she made clear one of their main goals was to create new opportunities for women and girls. That was music to FIFA's ears. Julie Bryce is an assistant professor at Cal State Fullerton, who is carrying out a sociocultural study of this summer's World Cup.
FIFA's had a lot of issues, a lot of corruption issues over the years. And so there's kind of a new brand that they're trying to get out there. And so this is part of that branding strategy, is really to push the women and girls game.
But these goals have been central to New Zealand's values for years. In 2018, the government's sport agency earmarked more than $6 million to increase the amount of women and girls participating in physical activity. Kylie Hawker-Green, who manages the country's major events, says that investment was made after nationwide research showed that girls just weren't staying in sports.
They often play sport at school, but they drop out when they get to high school and they don't come back.
So Hawker-Green and her team got to work. In the past 2 years, New Zealand has hosted the Women's Cricket World Cup.
Oh, what a hand! What a grab!
And the Women's Rugby World Cup, which they happened to win.
And in your life, have you ever seen anything like it?
The idea is that the impact from these high-profile events will build on each other. From an earnings standpoint, though, soccer is clearly the top dog. FIFA predicts more than $400 million will be poured into Australia and New Zealand's economies. But Hawker-Green says the real lasting legacy won't just be measured in cash, but in material improvements.
We have invested a significant amount of money.
More than $3 million.
Across the country in upgrading, and in some cases building new, gender-neutral facilities, so gender-neutral changing rooms.
She says many of New Zealand's sports facilities have primarily been built for and used by men, so they only had bathrooms with rows of urinals and open showers. Not anymore. Similar upgrades have been made across Australia, too, where only 1 in 5 soccer facilities had female locker rooms before these investments.
And so that obviously remains well after the tournament is gone. And so our players get to play in these world-class facilities that they would never have otherwise been able to access.
Thousands of young students in New Zealand will also take part in a government-funded school program called Kutuitui, a Maori word for interweaving. It uses the upcoming Women's World Cup to teach kids about culture and collective identity. Then there's a project called Fan Tales, where kids learn how to play soccer without the competitive aspect.
Fan Tales focuses on helping girls make friends, improve their skills, get active, build their confidence, and most importantly, have fun.
But New Zealand and Australia are far from the first countries to hope that hosting a major sports tournament will leave a lasting legacy in their local communities. Julie Bryce from Cal State Fullerton says there's little evidence to support what's called a trickle-down or inspiration effect.
Research overall is a little bit mixed, but in general, they said there's really no proof that that works, that you're going to see these massive participation numbers after a tournament such as the World Cup.
Take the 1999 FIFA Women's World Cup, for example. The U.S. hosted and won the tournament, and star players like Brandi Chastain, Brianna Scurry, and Mia Hamm became household names. At the time, there were similar hopes that the women's game would skyrocket in the States. It didn't happen. Since then,
there's been three women's professional leagues, two of which have folded in the United States because there hasn't been that much investment in those leagues.
Bryce notes that youth soccer participation has now gone up 37% for girls.
But that's 20 years later. So this takes a lot of time and a lot of investment and care.
In New Zealand, Hawker Green says she and her colleagues in Australia understand this is a long game. And while they are monitoring things like participation numbers now, she only expects to assess the real impacts in 5 to 10 years. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
A team of scientists say humans have changed the planet so dramatically, so completely, that we have created a new geological era on Earth. It's called the Anthropocene. The research team spent years trying to find one place on Earth that best exemplifies this phenomenon, a place that contains the best evidence neatly in one location. They settled on a spot, a lake in southern Ontario. Francine McCarthy is a professor of earth science at Brock University in Canada and part of the International Anthropocene Working Group. Francine, what was this global search about? Explain what exactly your group was looking for.
If you want to draw a line on the timescale, if you want to call a new geologic time interval, what you need is a place that is the poster child for it. The Anthropocene Working Group looked at 12 different sites on the planet to see if there was evidence that the planetary system, the way the Earth actually ticks, changed in the mid-20th century. And one of the sites was Crawford Lake. What gave Crawford Lake the edge is that it is well protected, but easily accessible. But the most important thing is that at the bottom of this very, very, very deep lake, the sediments accumulate without being disturbed, and like tree rings, we can identify each and every year.
And how easy is it to interpret the human activity that's embedded in that sediment?
So there are all sorts of records of pollutants, air pollution, particulate pollution. We see fly ash from the steel mills in Hamilton in the sediments of the lake, increasing dramatically in 1950. We can see evidence of a massive, rapid increase in human impact on the planet, basically overwhelming the ability of the planet to behave the way it used to.
I'm curious how you hope this designation impacts the public understanding of geologic time.
Having a geologic time that has anthropo, which means human, in the title will make people recognize that the Earth doesn't have a limitless capacity to just take whatever we throw at her. We have to recognize that there comes a point where the system shifts. So we've all experienced changes in Earth's system in terms of more heat waves, droughts, climate extremes that we've been experiencing. It's bigger than just what we understand as climate. If we recognize and accept that those are of human origin, accepting responsibility for that, both individually and collectively, I think are important things.
I just want to point out that Crawford Lake was one of a couple of finalists your group was focused on, along with a bay in Japan and another lake in China. It is kind of hard to imagine that a place illustrative of massive human impact gives you proud bragging rights. But do you feel some gratification that Crawford Lake was chosen?
Yeah, I think having a small, pretty lake, you're not tempted to look away because there's a bunch of garbage floating in the water or anything. It is beautiful, and yet its sediments at the bottom of the lake hold the best evidence of massive, overwhelming shift in the planet being overwhelmed by the actions of humans.
Francine McCarthy is a professor of earth science at Brock University in Canada. We were talking about a lake in Ontario, Canada, that was chosen to show evidence that the Anthropocene era has taken shape. Francine, great to speak with you. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
A two-day NATO summit is wrapping up in Lithuania today. Sweden is expected to soon become a full-fledged member. Ukraine is eager to join the military alliance, too. The World's Daniel Hoffman has the latest.
Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky arrived to a hero's welcome yesterday in the Lithuanian capital.
Thanks, Lithuania. Thank you very much.
Zelensky spoke to a crowd of thousands of people in central Vilnius. He thanked Lithuanians for supporting Ukraine in the face of Russia's invasion, but his main message going into the NATO summit was very clear.
NATO дасть Україні безпеку.
Zelensky said that Ukraine makes NATO stronger. But here's the bottom line. Ukraine is not a member of the alliance, at least not yet. This is Jan Stoltenberg, the Secretary General of NATO, speaking earlier today.
We reaffirmed that Ukraine will become a member of NATO.
The key word is will become a member. It's like offering an invitation, but without an actual date or address.
There's always been this question about whether or not Ukraine and Georgia would eventually be members of the NATO alliance.
That's Rachel Rizzo from the Atlantic Council's Europe Center. She says Ukraine has been trying to sort out a clear path to NATO membership for years. The turning point came in 2008 at a previous NATO summit in Romania.
Here in Bucharest, we must make clear that NATO welcomes the aspirations of Georgia and Ukraine for their membership in NATO and offers them a clear path forward to meet that goal.
What happened in 2008 under pressure from then President George Bush was NATO allies agreed that Ukraine and Georgia at the time would eventually become members of the alliance, but they made no clear plan or pathway as to when or how that might happen.
Since the start of Russia's full-scale invasion, as NATO member states have rushed to assist Ukraine, that pathway to join the alliance remains uncertain. At this week's summit, U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan was asked about President Biden's position on Ukraine joining NATO.
The president said quite simply that he's not prepared to have Ukraine in NATO now because it would mean that the United States and NATO would be at war with Russia now.
Here's Rachel Rizzo again.
The meaning and oomph behind the membership in NATO comes from what's known as Article 5, which is the mutual security guarantee that underpins the entire alliance. It basically says an attack against one is an attack against all and obliges countries by treaty to come to the defense of an ally should they be attacked.
In Ukraine's case, though, the country is currently at war with Russian forces occupying large swaths of its territory. So NATO allies have embraced Ukraine as a partner, saying that its future is with NATO, but the timeline remains open-ended.
What the communique said was that Ukraine can join NATO when all allies agree and when certain conditions are met. That leaves a lot of room for interpretation. That is not the clear pathway or the clear timeline that Zelensky was hoping for.
Still, Ukraine is not walking away from Vilnius empty-handed. Zelensky acknowledged that today when he said, "The results of the summit are good. NATO is creating a new council to strengthen ties with Ukraine. It's also streamlining the process for Ukraine to join the alliance by waiving something called the Membership Action Plan. And finally, new security guarantees were announced. The G7 nations are now pledging long-term military assistance for Ukraine's self-defense." For The World, I'm Daniel Hoffman.
Paris is taking a look at oversized SUVs in its tight city center and saying no, or at least pay up. That story's just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Paris is taking a step to clean its air and streets and help combat climate change. The city will soon charge SUVs extra to park in the city center, tackling a problem that many say has grown out of control, auto obesity. Sylvain Delaverne is the France coordinator for the Clean Cities campaign and joins us from Bordeaux. So Sylvain, Paris is targeting SUVs and big heavy cars. How exactly would Paris's new plan actually work?
So it's basically sliding scale according to the weight of your car. You would be overcharged if your car is bigger than expected. So you pay more according to your weight, basically.
Yes, yeah, so starting next January 1st, will cars actually be weighed before entering the center of Paris?
Yeah, exactly. So the first city is not actually Paris, it's Lyon, one of the second or third biggest city in France. And this scale has been set there, and it would take place in January, in 2024.
Do you think this is going to be an effective policy to deal with crowding in the city and climate change?
Yeah, well, the thing is, we have cars that are getting even larger and heavier every year, and car makers prioritize SUV, you know, with high profit margins instead of maybe lighter cars with more volume. And so cities have to incentivize in some way the driver to use lighter cars. So it's part of the solution, actually. It's one piece, but we need multiple measures, public measures, to make sure that tackle climate change. And this is not going to the right direction. So we really need those kind of policy measures, like obviously implementing some sliding scale for the parking price, but also maybe getting rid of a lot of parking space that are useless and that are taking a lot of space for walkability and cycling.
Have you had a chance to look at the charges on that sliding scale, and will they be steep enough to change people's behavior?
So yeah, I had a chance to have a look at it. It would actually be doubling the price almost of the parking lot for the big cars. But obviously, this would not prevent rich people that can afford SUV to get rid of it. It's just one measure among others.
I mean, the number of SUVs in Paris, I see, has grown by 60% over the past 4 years. And Europe has long been the place where cars are designed for the streets, not the other way around. Why are more Parisians driving SUVs, and when did that start?
To answer your question simply, I would say that car makers have a big responsibility with the marketing and the imaginary they sell, and we need to change that. We need to change behavior, and we need to change consumption behavior. And there is another element, that is to also have a new strategy to relocate the industry, because we tend to produce those SUVs in India and China, while we could absolutely, and we need that, produce some light cars made in France or made in Europe.
So Paris and Lyon will set up these charges for SUVs come January 1st. You expect other cities in France potentially will adopt the same policy?
I really believe in contagion by example, you know, and I think those are very good examples, Paris and Lyon, and Grenoble already has announced that he might follow the lead of Lyon and Paris. There is something that is very important also for Clean Cities to mention, is that we pledge for a transformation of cities, but that is not just for environmental purpose, but need to be a pillar of the transformation is social justice. And we really think it would work only if we take care of this aspect also.
Sylvain Delaverne is the France coordinator for the Clean Cities campaign, speaking with us about a new scheme in Paris and Lyon beginning next year to charge SUVs extra for parking in the center of the city. He joined us from Bordeaux. Sylvain, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Food from kitchens in the Mexican state of Sonora, just south of Arizona, almost always means grilled beef, carne asada. But here's a twist. A growing number of Sonorans are going vegan. From the Fronteras desk in the Sonoran capital, Hermosillo, KJZZ's Kendall Blust has our story.
Hoy presentamos cómo ser vegano en Sonora.
It's a typical Sonoran barbecue or carne asada. In the video, a young woman sits downcast at a picnic table while others chow down on tacos.
Sin perderte ninguna carnita asada.
Suddenly, she perks up, grabs a container of soy-based carne asada, and joins her family and friends in the festivities. How to be vegan in Sonora without missing a single carne asada is the concept behind Veggie Tacos, a business Ligia Rojas started with her mom in 2017 selling vegan alternatives to Sonoran favorites.
Como buenos sonorenses que somos, que nos gusta
Rojas says she and her family are proud sonorenses. And like many people who switch to a vegetarian or vegan lifestyle, they still want to enjoy traditional dishes.
O el pastor, o la machaca, o quieres hacerte unos burritos paseados también.
Grilled
o
sea, pork, todo barbecued goat, cow's head. She says there's no reason to miss out just because someone no longer eats meat or is just cutting back.
Buscando que cuando tú hagas ese cambio, no lo sufras.
She sells the veganized versions by the liter and twice a week at the Veggie Tacos Taqueria in her family's carport. The recipes are the same ones her mom made for her growing up, back when she says it was a lot harder to find vegetarian options in Hermosillo.
Aquí en Hermosillo, siendo como la capital de la
the
carne,
beef
como
capital dice, ¿no? of Mexico, there's no denying that Sonora is known for its carne.
El taco de asada para mí sería el rey.
In recent years, Hermosillo's gastronomy has been highlighted by well-known chefs.
Soy yo. El de carne asada.
The Netflix series Taco Chronicles and in the LA Times. And failingly, carne asada reigns large. Why wouldn't it? It's the pride of Sonora. But like others around the world, a growing number of Sonorans are changing their diets. Tofu and vegan cheese are on the shelves at grocery stores. There are a couple dozen vegan restaurants, including coffee shops, hot dog stands, and burger joints. And even places typically lacking veggie options, like seafood restaurants, are putting vegan dishes on the menu.
Conocer que no se necesita ningún animal para dar el sabor.
Chef Ivan Tapia says you don't need meat for great flavor. He went vegan several years ago after spending time with Sonora's indigenous communities, which he says gave him a new perspective on animals' lives. One day he started to eat a taco and broke down crying. He hasn't eaten animal products since. But it can be hard giving up meat in a place like Hermosillo. Family and friends worry about your health, and social situations can be tough. That's the whole concept behind Beatriz Carvajal's restaurant, Vegana del Norte. Delicious, fun, fast food.
Comida divertida, exactamente.
Vegana del Norte started out of Carvajal's home shortly after she became vegan about 8 years ago. Now she's sitting under a red and yellow sign outside her newly opened restaurant. In the kitchen, onion rings and french fries sizzle in the fryer, and soy adobada and a lentil-based veggie patty heat up on the grill. A fried tofu chicken sandwich, barbecue veggie burger, and birria tacos are among the most popular items on the menu, she says. Like many vegans she knows, she says giving up meat inspired her cooking. That's also true for the duo behind Esquina Vegana.
Me dedico a contrabandear gluten.
Elizabeth Nunez calls herself a gluten smuggler.
Es decir, soy panadera.
In other words, a baker. She learned to cook as a teenager when she gave up meat. And a few months ago, she teamed up with longtime vegan cook Monica Pacheco to open a new restaurant serving traditional favorites with a vegan twist.
Una opción vegana, monchosa a la hora de la noche.
She says it's something the city was missing. Tasty, late-night vegan munchies. And she calls their food a bit transgressive.
Es un tanto transgresor.
Food is culture, she says, and their food bucks the idea that meat is essential to Sonoran identity. For The World, I'm Kendall Blust in Sonora, Mexico.
And you're listening to The World. A filmmaker was part of the last reporting team in Mariupol, Ukraine. His camera documented life in the besieged city just before it was captured by Russian forces.
And it seemed like a nightmare. It's just a recurring nightmare that you cannot stop. But you still keep filming. That's the only thing you can do.
His new film about what he saw opens in theaters soon. Our preview ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. For centuries, people who lived in what today we know as Iraq have relied on water from two rivers, the Tigris and Euphrates. In 2016, the United Nations named the marshes of southern Iraq, where the rivers meet, a UNESCO World Heritage Site. But it's an ecosystem in danger. The World's Shirin Jafari brings us this report on what it means for the people who live there.
Ali Abbas Hassan has been a farmer in southern Iraq for two decades. One of his main crops, he tells me, was wheat. He planted in the fall and would need to water his field four times a day. Year after year, he says, water became more scarce. And there's no other source except the Tigris and Euphrates. Hassan made it work for a while, but recently the lack of clean water for his crops became too much. He decided to sell his farm. I loved farming, he says. It's beautiful work. It's hard to suddenly lose what you worked so hard for. Hassan is not the only farmer who sold his land in recent months. He tells me several others have done the same. No water, no crops, no income. Experts say what's happening in southern Iraq is alarming. The Tigris and Euphrates will be completely dry by 2040. That warning came from Iraqi water expert Jamal Ibrahim al-Halbousi on television last month. I don't think Iraqi leaders really understand, he said. This is the end of Iraq as a country, as a civilization. Iraq won't exist without its two rivers, he added. Environment activist Laith Ahmed shared this video with me. It shows a man riding a boat in Iraq's marshes. There's a thick layer of dead fish floating on top. What a shame, what a shame, he declares. When Laith Ahmed sees things like these, he says his heart breaks.
You feel you are losing the life.
He tells me about the people of Iraq's marshlands, known as the Marsh Arabs, who've been living on the banks of the rivers for centuries, fishing, farming, and raising water buffaloes. Their troubles began in the 1990s, when the government of Saddam Hussein drained large swaths of the marshlands to punish the people for rebelling against him. A series of canals diverted the water, drying up 90% of the marshes. 500,000 people were displaced. Over the years, marshlands have slowly started to recover. But today, Laith Ahmed says the people of the region face a new ecological disaster.
When they lose the water, they cannot live anymore because they are losing their buffaloes. So they moved from the marshland to other cities.
This week, the United Nations said southern Iraq is experiencing its worst heat wave in four decades. The water levels have also dropped significantly. Ahmed Bayram of the Norwegian Refugee Council says several factors contribute to Iraq's water crisis. Extreme heat waves, low rainfall, and two decades of war that destroyed Iraq's water infrastructure. Making things worse is the construction of dams in neighboring Iran and Turkey.
These farming communities around the marshes, they have been there for centuries. Generation after generation have kept that land, have looked after that land. These families are now rethinking their future, and that's what really worries us when people leave their land.
When farmers leave, he says, Iraqis across the country suffer, because that will likely mean food insecurity. Last year, Bayram and his team found that some farmers in southern Iraq had lost up to 90% of their harvest. The water situation is not much better in cities.
Tap water is not usable unless you are like using it to wash clothes or something like this.
39-year-old Zuhair Muhammad lives in Basra in southern Iraq. He says he has to buy bottled water every week for drinking and cooking.
The cost for water like every week, my household, approximately $7 to $10.
Price he can afford, but many others can't. That's why people are moving to other parts of the country where water is more accessible. Meanwhile, as Iraq dries up and as the impacts of climate change make life more difficult, people like Laith Ahmed are trying to raise awareness about protecting the marshlands. He posts about this on social media.
I'm in love with the nature. I want to be part of saving this nature and the biodiversity in Iraq.
He hopes his work changes people's minds, especially those in the Iraqi government, pushing them to do more. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
One of the biggest names in European literature in recent decades has died. Czech-born author Milan Kundera is best known for his 1984 novel, The Unbearable Lightness of Being, a story set during the 1968 Prague uprising, and the absurdity of living in a repressive communist regime. It was adapted into an Academy Award-nominated film starring Daniel Day-Lewis and Juliette Binoche. Kundera died yesterday in Paris at the age of 94. Jorn Boysen is a professor of French literature at the University of Copenhagen. Jorn, remind us first of all about The Unbearable Lightness of Being. In a nutshell, what was the book about and why did it have such a huge following?
I think one of the reasons for the success of the movie and the novel behind it was because it was in a political context. It was seen as a kind of dissident novel against the communist regime. Even in your presentation here, you mention it. And it is a part of that. But behind of it is understanding life. I think that was the key problem for Kundera. And he gave some pretty basic questions. What is love? What is being me? What is responsibility? And he kind of gave an exploration of that in his novels. You know, many modernist novelists are pretty difficult to read. If you take Joyce or Proust, they'll make you sweat. You'll have to work hard. But Kundera was kind of bright, really interesting, really deep, and easy to read at the same time. So you can kind of, you have your cake and eat it too.
So The Unbearable Lightness of Being, I mean, it's basically a successful surgeon who quits his work, his profession, become a window washer after he refuses to pledge allegiance to the Soviet Union. I mean, it may be subtle. Kundera did not lack a sense of humor, did he?
There's always a paradox in the heart of everything Kundera writes. So it's kind of the police state at the time forces him out. But then again, he finds freedom. So that's kind of everything Kundera does ends somehow in a paradox.
Hmm. We should note that The Unbearable Lightness of Being is also a pretty racy book, and raciness set in a time of protest and political repression in a Czechoslovakia behind the Iron Curtain. Kundera wrote it, though, in exile in Paris. You called it an easy read, a page-turner. What else about this book resonated in the West?
The timing was just right. The whole change in the Eastern Bloc in the 80s, and you had this kind of view behind the Eastern Bloc, and you had, I think when it was translated, and it was translated right away in all the major Western languages, you saw it kind of, okay, this is the cry for freedom. So it appeared in a very political context.
Kundera joined the French literary scene after 1975, having been expelled from the Czechoslovakian Communist Party. Did that change him?
In the beginning, no, not really. He wanted to stay in Czechoslovakia. There's a famous interview of him in 68, just right after the Russian invasion. Well, no Czech author wants to leave Czechoslovakia. We're going to stay here. Life became gradually more unbearable for him. So he was kind of forced to leave in the early 70s. And he didn't want to, even though he couldn't work as a writer. But then he came to France and kind of, okay, I'm 40. I'm going to start a new life. And that's what he did. If you read the biography that he has put in his own works, that's just kind of two lines. He was born in Czechoslovakia. In 1975, he moved to France.
That's it. Amazing.
He wrote in Czech for the first couple of novels as his major works. And then he switched to French some years later. I think more or less as getting used to work and speaking French all of the time. Why not write in French? Why not enter French literature and become a French author? And that's what he did.
Reinvention. Jorn, you spoke with Kundera yourself while writing about him. What was he like as a person, and was he ever bitter about leaving Prague and his country?
I was writing a book, it's like 20 years ago now, and I got a phone call one evening. I said, well, this is Milan Kundera. It's having a phone call from God or something. I was really not able to utter any sensible words at that thing. But he invited me and my girlfriend to his house in Paris, and extremely friendly. Very curious about what people said about him and wrote about him. And he wanted to kind of check and have some kind of control, I think. A really, really nice man. And we kept contact. And when I was in Paris, we went out for a drink sometimes. And I really grew fond of him. And he didn't answer any questions relating to his personal life or to his books. He wanted to hide his own agendas, that kind of stuff. You didn't get any sensible answers. He would tell jokes, anecdotes, talk about politics, whatever, but he wouldn't answer a question. Why did you do that? And how do you think this happens? And he refused to comment in that way on his own work and his own trajectory.
I hope he was a good joke teller.
he was a very warm personality, so it was very funny and very, in a way, kind of sad at the same time, but good company.
Milan Kundera wrote of a certain time in 20th century history. Jorn, like 100 years from now, how do you imagine he'll be read and seen? What will be his legacy?
I don't know if it's a very French thing, but the French are very fond of people coming from abroad and entering French literature. And I think it is very flattering that a great author wants to change language, like Samuel Beckett did too. So I think they will see, okay, this is an Eastern European voice with a French accent and with a very unique and very original view on the novel and the role of the novel in the life of everybody.
Jørn Boysen is a professor of French literature at the University of Copenhagen, helping us remember Czech novelist Milan Kundera, who died yesterday at the age of 94. Jørn, thank you very much. Good to speak with you.
Nice talking to you.
Since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, nearly 300,000 Ukrainians have received asylum in the UK. Several programs have eased the transition, like Homes for Ukraine, which matches Ukrainians with British host families. Ukrainians can also work freely in the UK for up to 3 years. Now there are calls to extend such programs to asylum seekers from Sudan. Sudan, you may recall, is a former British colony where war broke out in mid-April. Reporter Rebecca Rossman spoke with people in London's Sudanese community who accused the British government of a double standard.
63-year-old Naglia Sadiq Ahmed Mustafa sits me down on a park bench in northwest London. She carefully pulls out an old photo from an envelope of her son Mazen on his wedding day in 2014.
He went through lots of tragedies.
Tragedies such as losing his first wife, Huda, who died during childbirth. The most recent tragedy came in mid-April when Mazen, who lives in the Sudanese capital of Khartoum, found himself trapped in a war zone. That's when two opposing military generals launched the country into a civil war, which to date has killed over 1,000 civilians and displaced more than 2.5 million.
My son, my flesh and blood, he's there in, amongst the war.
When they last spoke, Mazen escaped the shelling and bombings in Khartoum. He's now staying with family in central Sudan. But the situation remains precarious. Hospitals are barely operating, and electricity, food, and water are scarce. Naglia Sadiq Ahmed Mustafa herself is a Sudanese-British national. An activist and journalist in her home country, she came here as a refugee about 20 years ago and now works as a translator. She tells me she's been working tirelessly to get her son and his family into the UK.
I emailed the Ministry of Foreign Affairs here asking, what can I do? My son is there and he's under in dangerous situation. They said, go to the government website. They replied to me and apply for a standard visit visa.
But the British Embassy in Khartoum closed shortly after the conflict began, leaving people like Mazen stuck in limbo.
And there is no embassy in Sudan, no embassy open in Sudan to apply for a visa.
Since April, there have been multiple calls for the British government to open up a special sanctuary program for Sudanese refugees looking to escape the conflict, as was done for Ukrainians fleeing the Russian invasion. But to date, the government has shown no signs of offering Sudanese refugees a safe and legal route to the UK.
The tragic situation in Sudan has really highlighted the, frankly, hypocrisy of the British system in this space, really.
Mark Davies is the head of communications and campaigns at the British Refugee Council. He applauds the British government for changing its asylum policies within a month of Russia's invasion of Ukraine to welcome hundreds of thousands of Ukrainian refugees.
But for Sudanese people seeking to come to this country for whatever reason, it's that much harder, though, for someone from Sudan to seek asylum in this country.
Activists have accused Britain's Home Office of operating a racist refugee system, but government officials have said their priority is to end the fighting in Sudan. Pressed about the situation, the British Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, has told reporters the government had, quote, no plans to start looking into safe routes for refugees from Sudan. Here she is speaking to Sky News in late April.
I'm asking what's going to happen to people who turn up in Dover on a small boat from Sudan.
Well, that's why we are passing a new law at the moment to deal with people who come here illegally. There is no good reason for anybody to get into a small boat and cross the channel in search of a life in the United Kingdom.
The bill is controversial here in the UK. It's meant to firmly establish that people arriving on small boats will be detained and deported. But it's not just an issue of refugees coming in. It's also about people who are already here.
Order, order. Welcome to this session of the Foreign Affairs Committee.
Last month, a parliamentary committee heard testimonies from several Sudanese nationals in the UK and NGOs. Maddie Crowder is the co-director of Waging Peace, which helps Sudanese asylum seekers process their asylum applications once they arrive on British soil. During her remarks, Crowder accused the government of keeping Sudanese nationals, quote, in limbo. She says the government is not processing their applications quick enough, which leaves them unable to work or access healthcare benefits.
Why are we not letting them rebuild here in the UK in the ways that we know they can and making the contributions we know they can?
Crowder says, according to the latest government figures from late March, more than 5,000 Sudanese are already in the UK waiting to have their asylum applications processed. And there are thousands more in other countries waiting to apply. For The World, I'm Rebecca Rossman in London.
A new film documenting the Russian assault on a Ukrainian city is about to open in New York. 20 Days in Mariupol. In the very first scene, before we even see the title, we are on the seventh floor of a hospital in this port city of Mariupol, looking out a window. It's overcast. Everything is gray. On the snow-covered street below, we see Russian tanks emblazoned with the white letter Z.
This is the first time I saw Z, the Russian sign of war. The hospital is surrounded. Dozens of doctors, hundreds of patients, and us.
The voice there of Mstislav Chernov. He's a videographer for the Associated Press, part of the last team of journalists to report from Mariupol. That was in March 2022. We reached Mstislav in New York. So 20 Days in Mariupol is a day-by-day, sometimes minute-by-minute diary of that siege of Mariupol. You arrived on February 24th. The first day of the Russian assault last year. What were you expecting when you got there?
Well, on 23rd, we realized that the war is going to start. It was a matter of days. And we knew that regardless of how it will unfold, whether it's going to be a full-scale invasion or Russians are going to be moving forward only in Donbass, the Mariupol will be a key target for them because for years, they wanted to have a corridor to Crimea. And therefore, we just spoke to our editors and we made a decision to go there and to be there as long as we can, to report as long as we can.
Right. Well, very quickly, you and residents of Mariupol got clear signs of what the assault was about and how intense it was going to be. Let's get into a few more moments from the film. This is on day three, and you're filming in a CrossFit gym, which has become an improvised bomb shelter. People are taping over the exercise mirrors. Describe the mood in the gym, Mstislav, early on in those 20 days.
Well, a lot of people decided to stay and not to leave the city. They and we did not expect things to unfold this quick and this violent. Now we know that the main tactics for Russia to take city is to destroy it completely, just to level it to the ground and then just walk over the ruins. Back then, we didn't know that. And so people were hiding in this shelter. About 2,000 people were hiding in this gym, and everyone hoped it will be finished soon or it will not be so violent. But later, as it unfolded, so many lives were lost, so many children. That was the mood.
Early on, you're at the emergency room entrance to a local hospital.
We're interrupted by an ambulance siren.
So this ambulance arrives with a child who's injured by shelling. I mean, we see similar scenes with children and babies in your documentary over and over again. What do you recall, Mstislav, about this first time that you watched doctors trying to save a kid's life?
I've been covering this war, the Russian invasion in Ukraine by that time already for 8 years. But it felt at that moment when doctors tried to save the child and they were crying. I felt that the war for me, like real war, started at that moment. And I thought, what could be worse? But then the next day, another child was brought. And the next day, another child was brought. And it seemed like a nightmare. It's just a recurring nightmare that you cannot stop. But you still keep filming. That's the only thing you can do. You know, you feel helpless. You feel angry. And doctors asking you, please show this to the world. let this stop, and nothing happens.
I'm speaking with Associated Press cameraman and filmmaker Mstislav Chernov about his new film, 20 Days in Mariupol. You were sending all your footage to the Associated Press. It was being seen on newscasts around the world. Talk about the responsibility your crew took on as the only Western journalist who remained in Mariupol.
When we realized that the city will be surrounded, it was quite a simple choice whether we stay and keep trying to follow all the security protocols and try to film, or we escape with other journalists. And as a Ukrainian, as a part of the society, I'm trying to tell stories and history. I felt that I needed to stay. It's my duty to stay and keep recording.
Right. I mean, and you do. And at one point you say, my brain desperately wants to forget all this, but the camera will not let it happen. What sort of memory have you constructed with the making of this film?
I want it to be, I can't say full record, but as good record as possible of what unfolded there. Because later on, my children or their children, when they look back and they will ask, what happened to Mariupol? What happened on the first days of Russia's full-scale invasion to Ukraine? They will watch this film and it will give them an understanding.
So, Mstislav, you just arrived from the front line in Ukraine in New York for the screening of 20 Days in Mariupol. The city is still under Russian occupation. What do you know about life there today? And can you imagine going back?
I wish, and all my colleagues who were with me, the team, also, we want this film someday to be screened in liberated Mariupol. This is kind of our dream. But also, I would like to make a film on the liberation of the city. However, currently, it's impossible. The city is occupied and deep in occupied territory. And Russia have tried to make a propaganda example out of it. So they've built several apartment blocks, which are mostly given to Russian citizens. And they knocked down hundreds of buildings, were just burnt and bombed. And these buildings are knocked down with all the bones of people who died there. So all the evidences are erased. And we know the official number is 25,000 people. But our estimate number of victims in the siege is around at least 50 to 70,000. But we will only be able to know how many people died there when the city will be deoccupied. And they're forcefully giving Russian passports to citizens. They make these lists of potential traitors. So it's very hard to be Ukrainian in the occupied territories. But that happens everywhere. All the occupied cities live through the same nightmare.
Associated Press cameraman and filmmaker Mstislav Chernov has been telling us about his new film, 20 Days in Mariupol. It is hard to watch, but it's an important document of this war. It opens Friday, July 14th in New York City. Mstislav, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong, and as always, thank you for listening.